You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 2nd of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and also just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's show...
Rouhani doesn't sound like Ahmadinejad, but when it comes to Iran's nuclear weapons program, the only difference between them is this. Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing. Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Last week was all about Iran. Is this week all Israel? Following a Persian charm offensive, Bibi Netanyahu fought back yesterday at the UN. Rachel Shabby and Shashank Joshi tell us how he did and whether anyone was really listening. A new media project in the Netherlands ditches the concept of a news agenda out the window.
Our authors can discuss or make news of anything they deem important. It doesn't need a relationship to current affairs in the general sense of the word.
We'll also meet Nicholas Lovell, author of The Curve, From Freeloaders to Superfans, for coffee and chat at the Monocle Cafe.
The Curve comes in three parts. Find an audience, be able to speak to them again, and allow them to spend very variable amounts of money, ranging from very little up to hundreds, thousands, or tens of thousands.
All that plus new music from Haim and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield, right now. So, as ever, rather a lot to cram into the next hour. Before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines for around the world.
The partial shutdown of the US government entered its second day as Democrats and Republicans continue to battle over funding in Congress. The bitter standoff has forced the first government shutdown in 17 years. In Washington, the National Mall, usually teeming with tourists, was deserted as the surrounding museums and memorials remained shut to visitors. Ellen Bruckner is a tourist from New York.
It sends a terrible message. It sends a message, don't come to the United States unless you're sure everything's going to be open. And it says that here a small group of politicians have tied up the entire city here.
More than 700,000 federal employees have been placed on unpaid leave. But in Washington, Republican lawmakers, including Stephen Palazzo from Mississippi, defied the shutdown to allow a group of veterans to visit the National World War II Memorial.
We just opened the gates and allowed 91 World War II veterans to come see their monument that was erected in their honor. And it feels great.
A little civil disobedience.
Someone said that, a little civil disobedience. Sometimes it's better to ask forgiveness than it is permission. And we've asked permission. We just, no one really told us no.
Other news now, four more members of Greece's Golden Dawn party appeared before investigating magistrates today to enter pleas on charges of belonging to a criminal organisation. The men were arrested following the killing of an anti-fascist rapper. The Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta has won a confidence vote in the Senate. Just ahead of the vote, Italy's centre-right leader Silvio Berlusconi, faced with an imminent party split, backtracked on his threat to bring down the government. The Senate voted 235-70 in favour of retaining the government. Leonardo Molino from Luiss University in Rome thinks events in the Senate could herald the end of Berlusconi's political career.
If there is a postponement of the elections, that these elections will be later on, say next February or spring, or at this point even after European elections, then I expect that we a sort of a strong decline for Berlusconi and maybe the beginning of the end of him as a political leader.
In the United States, a pilot was forced to make an emergency landing on a Florida motorway during a routine inspection flight. Curtis Boulevard was flying with a customer who was set to buy the vintage plane when it suddenly lost power as it approached Spruce Creek Airport.
As we descended from 5,000 feet, getting closer and closer to Spruce Creek, I made the judgment and I knew that we weren't going to make the runway. So instead of continuing on to Spruce Creek and ended up in the woods or in the trees, where we probably wouldn't make it, we made a turn and decided to put it on State Road 415 because that was the best choice.
And finally, a thief was caught not so much red-handed as green-faced here in London after breaking into a car that sprayed him with a liquid that glows emerald under ultraviolet light. Yafat Askali, who's 28, denies entering the vehicle that police set up with a dye trap in Harlesden, northwest London, to catch thieves. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.05 here in London. It's 13.05 in New York City. You're listening to Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London, Londres.
Questo è Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monaco, vada a City Check.
From London,
London, London,
caralho.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Midori House here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today are Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands, and Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI. Shabby and Shashank, welcome to the show.
Good evening. I don't know
what to say to that.
No, don't say anything to that.
Okay.
We're going to start talking today about the United Nations General Assembly, which seems to have finally just about come towards some sort of a conclusion. It seems to have gone on long enough. And it ended with Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, which we're going to play a little bit of, and then have a bit of a chat about what it says. But I've just looking at it in front of me, and he says in his third line here, the Jewish people's odyssey through time has taught us two things. Never give up hope. Always remain vigilant. Hope charts the future. Vigilance protects it. Before we hear a bit from it, Rachel, I think that's the first time I've ever heard Netanyahu use the word hope.
It might be. It's the first time I've heard him use that. A lot of Israeli commentators as well were saying that, you know, this speech, he starts off talking about this lovely historical relationship between Jews and Persians. He mentions the Persian king Cyrus, who ended the Babylonian exile of the Jewish people. And all these commentators went, oh, my God, he's about to change direction. But no, he didn't.
No, he certainly didn't.
And back to all the usual tirades against Iran.
He did. Let's hear a first chunk of that right now.
Rouhani doesn't sound like Ahmadinejad. But when it comes to Iran's nuclear weapons program, the only difference between them is this. Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing. Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing. A wolf who thinks he can pull the wool over the eyes of the international community. Well, like everyone else, I wish we could believe Rouhani's words. But we must focus on Iran's actions. And it's the brazen contrast, this extraordinary contradiction between Rouhani's words and Iran's actions that is so startling. Rouhani stood at this very podium last week and praised Iranian democracy. Iranian democracy, he said. But the regime that he represents executes political dissidents by the hundreds and jails them by the thousands. Rouhani spoke of, quote, the human tragedy in Syria. Yet Iran directly participates in Assad's murder and massacre of tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in Syria. And that regime is propping up a Syrian regime that just used chemical weapons against its own people.
Shashanki's kind of got a point there, isn't it? It's quite hard to disagree with any of that.
I think apart from the very first bit, which is his absolute conviction that Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And I think the difficulty there is he is running completely against the diplomatic tide, which is to say, give Rouhani a chance, because even if he is a wolf, there actually isn't an awful lot of harm in testing his intentions. On the rest of it, on Iran's internal lack of democracy, on its execution of dissidents, on all of that, I think he certainly has a point. But of course, let's remember here, Rouhani has also freed 80 political prisoners, and things will only get better when people like him, who are insiders, can make those steps without provoking a backlash, as has occurred so many times in Iran's past.
Rachel, is part of the problem that Netanyahu has that, and in a way it was quite symbolic that he was speaking last once most people had left town, is that the show has gone on without him, that it's moved on, that now that all the talk, as Shashank says, is about, well, let's give this guy a chance, let's see what we can do. There was a historic phone call, if a 10-minute chat on the phone can really be historic. And Netanyahu's kind of been left behind.
Yeah, definitely. He looks isolated and he looks out of touch, but that is also his concern. I mean, from Netanyahu's perspective, not that I agree or condone this perspective in any way, but for him, I don't think this is really anything to do with Iran having nuclear weapons or not, so much as the idea of Iran becoming friendly with the US terrifies a sort of Netanyahu-style approach to Israel, because it means that there's a sort of geopolitical shift that Israel can't really countenance, that it means it will be on its own, that the US will have a different focus in the Middle East. And that's the bit that's really scary to Netanyahu and the bit that he wants to avoid at all costs, which is why he's being his usual sort of belligerent self now, even when the tide has turned so obviously against him.
It's kind of astonishing, Shank, isn't it, to see how far we've travelled? Because if we think of the last UN General Assembly, the big moment there was Bibi Netanyahu getting up with his picture of a cartoon bomb, with his big red marker pen, and noting the red line.
Yes.
Not that I think most people would struggle to remember what that red line even was now.
Yes.
And it just shows how what sort of difference a year can make.
Well, what's ironic, of course, is that the red line Netanyahu set last year was to say Iran can't accumulate a certain amount of enriched uranium up to 20%, which is 9/10 of the way to weapons grade. And interestingly, Iran has scrupulously observed that red line. Mm. So in a way, Netanyahu can in fact claim a little bit of vindication. But the problem is it worked so well that Iran proceeded along other tracks. And I think now Netanyahu simply is slightly befuddled. He has no way of raising the alarm without appearing he's simply the boy who cried wolf. Not that that really stopped him from quite literally crying wolf.
Well, in a way, Rachel, could he not have actually, in a sense, got up on stage there and claimed some sort of victory, saying, look, because of the pressure that we've put on, because we warned the rest of the world about what a threat this regime is, they've now elected a new president who has been forced to take a more conciliatory line. They've taken our warnings about this red line seriously as well. He could have perhaps turned it around a little bit there.
He could have done. I mean, he could have brought out another Acme bomb with a sort of before and after red line, just to sort of make sure that we got that it was him that achieved this. But, you know, there is the argument to be made that both that warning that was, delivered not just by Israel and Netanyahu, of course, but by the US and the international community, but also the crippling sanctions that have been imposed on Iran for some time now and are debilitating and which Iran is desperate to remove, both of those have actually had the desired effect in getting Iran to change its tack on the nuclear issue. But why would Netanyahu do that? Why would he give any credit to Rouhani and Iran? I mean, even the fact that he didn't acknowledge this major shift about the Holocaust, that there has been such a change of tack coming mm-hmm. from Iran, even his absolute refusal to engage with that shows that, you know, the world might be changing, but Netanyahu is certainly not prepared
well,
to change
clear
with
what he's,
it.
It's clear what he's doing. He's reprising his role as the bad cop. He's trying to secure the best possible agreement by setting out his maximalist position. The danger is he gets ignored, he looks irrelevant, and he is left foundering instead of actually forcing a better deal.
I don't think there is a best possible agreement with Iran as far as Netanyahu is concerned. Any agreement with Iran is the worst possible agreement. I mean, the idea is to keep that country isolated away from diplomacy, and especially the kind of encouraging diplomacy that we're seeing now, because Iran becoming strong and an international player is to Israel's detriment, and Netanyahu is too keen to avoid that at all costs, or by his analysis, it's to its detriment.
There was another standout quote. I mean, the writing on this is not going to win many prizes. But he said, Rouhani thinks he can have his yellow cake and eat it too.
It's an awful analogy, of course, for anyone who really knows the history of that phrase.
Yes, you don't want to actually eat yellow cake at all. But I mean, the point he was trying to make there was that, you know, it's all very well if he's saying, we're happy to have some sort of talks, but look at what happened last time, Shashank, that they were trying to have talks, that Iran was quite happy to carry on enriching uranium and to who's to say they're not going to do the same again now?
He has a point there insofar as Rouhani's last tenure as negotiating chief on the nuclear file 10 years ago did end with Rouhani saying, well, I bought time for us to pursue other nuclear progress. But I think it's worth remembering here, Rouhani also suspended uranium enrichment for 2 years. It paused the program. It took the pressure off. It allowed the EU to negotiate with Iran. The problem we couldn't break through back then was the Americans weren't involved. So the Iranians couldn't really get what they needed. So all the time that was bought for diplomacy was wasted. Ahmadinejad then came in 2005. Enrichment restarted and the dispute began again. This time round, even if we only secured a modest deal, which wouldn't, of course, involve lifting all sanctions, but only some, and we froze the nuclear clock to buy time, that itself, in itself, would be a success. It would buy more time for us to hash out a fuller deal. So I'm not so sure that point really holds.
Rachel, when you look at the situation in Israel and public opinion in Israel, which has, you know, over the last few years has significantly hardened and become more towards the right, do you get any sense that the general public in Israel are starting to sort of look at what's happening in Iran and perhaps change their position at all?
Yeah, I think what's happened, I mean, you're right to say that Israel has moved towards the right and become very sort of hardline rightist, has shifted that way, but not when it comes to Iran. Interestingly, in the last few years, you've seen the opposite of that happening. You've seen people absolutely lose faith with Netanyahu's analysis of Iranians as the bad people who want to get us. Israelis don't seem to be falling for that. And crucially, that is something that's endorsed by sort of Israel's military leaders, who are listened to far more than Netanyahu, whose analysis is also that they don't want to go to war with Iran, that this is not something to open a sort of war channel over, and that is not remotely advisable. And so I think the Israeli people are very cynical and tired, just as the rest of us are, with Netanyahu bringing out this old script.
It's
again.
Also worth bearing in mind, of course, Yair Lapid, yeah. Israel's rather centrist finance minister, yeah, bought in as part of a coalition government, criticised Netanyahu for ordering Israeli diplomats to walk out on Rouhani's speech even before they'd heard the speech, which, as it turned out, was nothing to write home about, nothing special. But walking out, I mean, was seen as something, I think Lapid actually said, this is what the Arabs did to us, which I think actually the analogy doesn't quite hold, but it shows you how he's isolated within his own government.
I want to ask you about Rouhani and whether he is, a wolf in sheep's clothing, to use Netanyahu's phrase. There was an interesting a little back and forth on Twitter, of all places, between Rouhani and Jack Dorsey,
yes,
who created Twitter, because Rouhani's been using the social media quite a bit to try and prove that, yes, hey, look at me, I'm modern, I'm open, I'm engaging. And Jack Dorsey sent him a public message saying, hello, Mr. President, can people in Iran actually read your Twitter feed, and what are you going to do about that?
Yes.
And he replies and says, where are we here? I had it right from there. I'm trying to ensure that they are going to be comfortably be able to access all information globally, as is their right. It's almost, Shashank, as if he's saying, look, I'm doing my best,
yeah,
but,
exactly,
you know, I may be president, but you know what I'm up against.
Absolutely. We all know his powers are circumscribed. We know Khamenei is, of course, the supreme leader in Iran and exercises a veto. We also know Rouhani couldn't have taken some of the steps he's taken without some tacit approval from Khamenei, or explicit approval. I'm talking about decisions like the release of political prisoners. I'm talking about the decision to give so many interviews to the foreign media in the US. I'm talking about the quite costly decision to shift the entire nuclear file in Iran away from the Supreme National Security Council, which is dominated by hardliners, and to the foreign ministry, which is run by Mohammad Javad Zarif, this new US-educated foreign minister. All of those decisions suggest that Khamenei has empowered Rouhani at least in part, and Rouhani is seeking to maximize that empowerment, use the space he has as well as he can, but it will be a slow process. The last time an Iranian president moved too fast, which was, of course, President Khatami, the out-and-out reformist, rather than Rouhani, who's merely a pragmatist, he immediately provoked a huge backlash from within the system. What I'm optimistic about is that Rouhani's working within the system, and therefore his gains, however incremental, I hope, are more sustainable.
That's another argument for reaching out and engaging with this diplomacy, isn't it? Because he obviously has opposition for his moves within Iran. He's obviously
Absolutely.
Provoked a lot of displeasure. And, you know, if he's engaged with and worked with, that seems to be, you know, in everyone's best interest.
What's
at the
interesting
moment.
As well here as well is that the when you actually look at what either side has given up so far, it's a bit of a struggle to work out what anyone's given up. You know, there's, yes, right. as you say, 80 political prisoners have been released, but that's not going to bring down the Iranian regime. Right. Obama's had to give up, well, I mean, he had to make a phone call.
Well,
so there's the cost.
Someone lost 10 minutes on their phone contract.
He had to pay for a phone call.
Phone
but I mean, there's, you know, we're all sitting here going, isn't this diplomacy great? But actually, very little neither side's had to give anything up for us to just feel a little bit more comfortable.
Well, I disagree, actually. I think what they've given up is their security at home. Both sides. They've both opened themselves up to hardliners and their respective constituencies. So yeah. Rouhani, he faces substantial resistance and opposition from hardline newspapers. From Obama's part, of course, he faces enormous resistance from congressional leaders. So these are only words, but they are costly words. They are words that will incur a domestic political cost. And in doing so, they are signs of good faith in the negotiations that will begin next month in Geneva.
Let's take a little break there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Syria. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield, and I'm joined by Shashank Joshi and Rachel Shabby. We're back in a moment.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
After a whirlwind tour of Europe, Asia and Australia, Monocle's editors, designers and presenters continue celebrating the launch of the Monocle Guide to Better Living. The team is heading back to the continent to visit Geneva, Zurich, Stuttgart and Paris, bearing books, banter and some inspiration on ways to improve one's life. For more information on events in a city near you, go to book.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Rachel Shabby and Shashank Joshi. We're going to turn our attention now to Syria, where a team of international disarmament experts has just arrived. The first concrete step towards dismantling Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons stockpile. The team is from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, a group which, let's face it, very few of us had heard of just a few weeks ago. And it's the first time they've been tasked with destroying chemical weapons during a war. 19 chemical weapons sites have been identified, 7 of which are in active war zones. Earlier, we heard from Patricia Lewis, a nuclear scientist and combat arms expert here at Chatham House. She explained the practical challenges ahead for the team.
Well, the most important thing, and this is what is really good about the agreement and the UN Security Council resolution, is that they've prioritized their work really very well, in that they have decided to, first of all, dismantle and destroy the production and the mixing and filling equipment, because that, of course, will get rid of the ability in the future, whatever might happen, to be able to use these awful weapons in any massive way.
That was Patricia Lewis there from Chatham House. Shashank, how difficult is it going to be to for this group to actually neutralise the Syrian government's ability to launch another chemical attack?
Very difficult, and there's two reasons. One of them is you can't really move these things very easily, so you have to destroy them in place. It's actually illegal under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which Syria has now signed, to move them across state borders. So ironically enough, it would have been easier right. to move them before Syria signed up to this. And the second reason is inspectors are going to be shot at. But in terms of does it make it more difficult to use them, well, the most usable weapons are in small artillery shells that are deployed with Syrian armed force units. So the problem here isn't really technically how do you stop them using it. They can if they really want to. I think it's more important is the fact that why would they use them when they've signed up to this deal? There are inspectors in the country and they'll face quite immediate bombing if they try using them. So this isn't a technical problem. This is a political issue. Why would they now use chemical weapons again?
Rachel, do you worry that we've kind of taken our eye off what's really important in Syria over the past few weeks? So there's been such an emphasis on chemical weapons, as horrible as they are, but that since there's been a deal that's been signed and agreed and Russia seems to be on board and even the Syrian government saying, OK, fine, we'll give them up, that it's, you know, we're ignoring the fact that the war is still going on and we're not even talking about ending that yet.
Yeah, I think we lost focus with chemical weapons a bit, but I am much more encouraged by the situation now. I mean, 2 weeks ago, we were on the verge of, you know, airstrikes on Syria, which would have been catastrophic and made the situation much worse. And now we've entered this sort of miraculous situation where the US and Russia have carved out a deal that everybody agrees with and is now being acted upon. I mean, to me, that's quite an extraordinary achievement. And it is possible to make it work. And crucially, if it does work, then it sets in motion the kind of mechanisms of diplomacy, meaning that if these arms inspectors, removers are able to work in war zones unimpeded, that means that the two sides have negotiated some sort of ceasefire. And if they're able to do that for arms inspectors, then they're able to do that full stop. And that's quite a significant move.
Let me offer a slightly dissonant note. I'm one of those people who supported strikes, but then supported the plan is preferable to those strikes. However, I think we need to be open to the possibility that the effect this has had on rebel groups has been to essentially increase their sense of embitterment. It's probably contributed to the breakup of the FSA that we saw a week ago with rebel commanders peeling off to form an Islamist alliance, and they are furious at the West and the Americans for what they see as a failure to support them militarily. Now, of course, we were never going to come in and save the day anyway, but that's not how they see it. And it's possible, I think, that this does complicate the process of a so-called Geneva II peace conference insofar as the rebels are less inclined to come to the table now. If there's a ceasefire, I take your point, that would certainly help things along greatly. But I think most of the disarmament plan will take place without a ceasefire, and there are going to be lots of rebels who, in a sense, will see Russian personnel on the ground, even inspectors, as fair game for potshots. And it will make it very hard indeed to say, come to the table now, we've sold your interests out, which is how they see it.
But to be fair, that has been the problem all along.
Yeah.
That the opposition, which may have started off as quite a genuine opposition to a brutal dictator, morphed into an opposition that was rife with violent groups, some of them affiliated to Al-Qaeda, which the West and its allies in the region were supporting and financing and encouraging to believe had a realistic aim when they asked for the removal of Bashar al-Assad.
Well, there's still opposition, of course.
As a precursor to any negotiation. Now, that has always been the sticking point. But let's look at it in a wider context. We now have the US possibly talking to Iran, which means that Iran will possibly be a member of those part of those negotiations, which it always needed to be. As such a big player in that region, it made no sense for the US and the West to consistently veto Iran's participation in those talks. And now that is becoming a possibility, that together with the deal that the US and Russia agreed over chemical weapons could actually herald a political solution to the Syria crisis. And it's always going to be a political solution that ends this. There isn't really another way out.
I think this is one interesting case where we may see Rouhani's authority bifurcated. He may be empowered quite strongly on one aspect of Iranian policy, on the nuclear dispute. We may find, and I may be wrong, we just don't know at this point in time, he's considerably less empowered on the Syria conflict, where the IRGC plays a much more, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, that is, plays a much more central role in Syria policy than it does on the nuclear dispute. So I hope I'm wrong, and I hope you're absolutely right, but I do wonder whether he may be less empowered on that issue than we'd like to think at this point.
To wrap all this up and take a little bit of a step back, Rachel, can you think of a better week for diplomacy and international organisations like the UN than we've had in the past week in recent memory?
No, I think it's been really an extraordinary week for those of us who are used to watching the Middle East, as we all are, with this kind of fatalism and despair and sense of hopelessness and doom. It's actually been a really encouraging week. For the first time in a long time, we see a change that could have really significant shifts and have really significant consequences for people on the ground in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's ironic. I heard the Indian Prime Minister speaking at the UN saying in his opening remarks, the UN is absolutely screwed. And I thought, what an awful week to say that, because whatever else you think, it's at least played something of a useful role in bringing multiple sides together. What I would say is interesting, of course, is that you might say this all began because the US was interested in utterly ignoring the UN and striking Syria, by the way, which I still support. But it, I think, is worth pointing out that it may have pushed us to a solution within the confines of the UN and a UN Security Council resolution, which, on the whole, will always be preferable to unilateral action without international law.
Rachel Shabby, Shashank Joshi, we will leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. I'll tell you about that in a moment.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, dette er Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 18:31 here in London, 13:31 on the East Coast. You're listening to Aperitivo. In a moment, we're going to be heading to the Monocle Cafe to speak to author Nicholas Lovell. We'll also meet a new outlet that ditches the news agenda. We'll be playing some music as well. Haim, who else? And there's a bit more as well. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the headlines.
Thanks very much. The partial shutdown of the US government entered its second day as Democrats and Republicans continue to battle over funding in Congress. The bitter standoff has forced the first government shutdown in 17 years. Four more members of Greece's Golden Dawn Party appeared before an investigating magistrate today to enter pleas on charges of belonging to a criminal organisation. The men were arrested following the killing of an anti-fascist rapper. The Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta has won a confidence vote in the Senate. Just ahead of that vote, Italy's centre-right leader Silvio Berlusconi, facing with an imminent party split, backtracked on his original threat to bring down the government. The Senate voted 235 to 70 in favour of the government carrying on. And in the United States, a pilot was forced to make an emergency landing on a Florida motorway during a routine inspection flight. The pilot was flying with a customer who was set to buy the vintage plane when it suddenly lost power near Spruce Creek Airport. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
That's quite a way, Jonathan, to lose a potential customer, isn't it? If you suddenly lose power while trying to sort of sell it. And sir, you'll see we've got a wonderful engine here. Oh, no, no.
What a disaster, absolutely. It's okay. Ridiculous.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. 18:33 here in London. You're listening to Aperitivo. Time now for us to head down the road here from Midori House, right out the house, take a left down Chiltern Street, walk down the road. You'll find the Monocle Cafe, and today we'll find Alad John there. He's with the author Nicholas Lovell, who's just written a new book on the relationship of value, pricing and profit in a rapidly changing economy. It's called The Curve, From Freeloaders into Superfans, The Future of Business.
The curve started because one of the things that I really was thinking about was how can you continue to finance, particularly the creation of art, that also applies to fund your business, when the web is making so many things go free. And we see so many people terrified about the downwards pressure on prices of the web. And they don't see the flip side of what the web does, which is that easy sharing also makes it easy to build one-to-one connections with your audience. And once you can talk to somebody and you can build a relationship with them, you can start understanding what they want. You can start enabling them to spend lots of money on things they really value.
So it's kind of the personalization of the business transaction between the producer and the consumer, as in you can direct your product more directly at a potential customer.
So it absolutely is personalisation, but I suppose I'm not sure that I see this in the long term as being optional. So if the curve comes in three parts, find an audience, be able to speak to them again, and allow them to spend very variable amounts of money, ranging from very little up to hundreds, thousands or tens of thousands. I work on games with single customers who have spent £10,000 or more on a game over the lifetime. That's a very different mental picture or mental model of how the world works, of where you compared to where you make something, you fix the price, you put it out there in the world, and you hope that hundreds, thousands, or millions of people will pay £40 for a game, £20 for a book, £10 for a CD, or whatever. It's a way of saying, actually, that model only exists because that suited the retailer, it suited the mass market. Ordinary people value things at very different amounts.
It's a very challenging idea, then, that you can have a kind of price fluidity for a particular good, not just goods. How do you suggest companies or producers go about creating that kind of flexibility for their product?
Well, the first and arguably most contentious point is that in the long term, I'm not sure that you should try to sell content or that consumers will continue to value paying for content itself.
Content being?
Literally, books, or the content contained within books, the content contained within magazines, the content contained within an album.
That is contentious.
It is contentious, but let me clarify what I mean by that. What I mean by that is that the content itself is just an idea, but the ideas, both in the expression, give people a sense of feeling and self-expression and knowledge and understanding, which is what they're actually paying for, and also in the manifestation of how they consume it. To take the example of books, for 500 years we've had books, and they've had two roles. They've been an access device, some way you get access to the ideas, and they've been the ideas contained within it. It's only in the last 10 years or so that that distinction has become meaningful because you couldn't separate them. Now it turns out there's a whole bunch of people for whom the physical artifact of the book has no value. But there's other people who want to buy coffee table books, or even, I hope there'll be some people who buy The Curve and never read it but put it on their shelves because they want to be seen as the kind of person who reads The Curve. So it doesn't have to be externally facing. But when I get to the point of the content is, it's not the words themselves that have value. It's how the words make somebody feel, improve their knowledge, improve their information, how it makes them look to other people, how it makes them have a stronger sense of self.
So your book is a kind of a manifesto of how companies can connect to what you term as the freeloader at one end of the curve, and at the other end of the curve, the superfan. How do they go about doing that?
What a very broad question. There are multiple different ways. The starting point is you have to find an audience. If you are a musician, your audience or your potential audience is consuming your content for free, whether you like it or not. You know, legally, that's on Spotify and probably on YouTube. Probably legally, that is. Illegally, it will be on torrent sites all over the world. So you're already using free to find an audience. The trick is to turn from having found an audience into how can you get to a place where you can speak to them again. If you're not in the world of stuff that's naturally digital, if you're in the world of selling DIY products or fiberglass swimming pools that you install in somebody's back garden, you'll probably use content marketing. And what that means is producing how-to videos to show people how to hit a nail with a hammer, or what are the issues you need to think about before installing a fiberglass swimming pool. The problem is that most content marketing is essentially vaporware. It's just somebody makes some content because they think they should. But the next trick, having made something, is go, did you like it? Can I speak to you again? and you earn the right to communicate with people. And as you start talking to them, you can start figuring out what they value, what they want. You can sell stuff to them, which is the first phase, but then you can start understanding where else they might want to go, from spending a few $100 to a few $1,000 to a few tens of thousand dollars. The reason the book's called The Curve is that from freeloaders to superfans is a continuum, ranging from people who really don't care about what you do at all, to people who care enough to listen but not to spend, all the way up to people who love you so much they will pay huge amounts of money to in some way be connected with the creation of your art or the value in your business.
Looking into your book, could you perhaps fish out some concrete examples of companies or brands or producers that have used or are using this idea of fluid pricing?
Sure. So there's a number of examples which you would expect. The singer-songwriting, ukulele-playing musician Victoria Vox out of the US, who's never had a label, has a car and a house and the healthcare that you need in the US, from variable pricing, which involves... She originally did her own version of crowdfunding, where she got people to fund the creation of her album. She sold gigs for $1,500 and albums for $20 and everything in between. So that's the one you might expect. At the other end, one of my favourite examples is an American business called King Arthur Flour. They make flour, as in the stuff that you bake into bread, about the least digital product I can imagine. They've become the second largest flour brand in the US. They have a website full of recipes and how-to guides. They have a free phone number that people can call when there's having a kitchen disaster, and helpful, friendly bakers will tell them how to rescue their bread or their cake or whatever. Obviously, you can buy their flour in shops. You can go to their website and buy a whole bunch of baking paraphernalia and cookbooks and so on, all the way up to masterclasses, which they have in their on-site in their Vermont headquarters, $400 to learn how to bake gluten-free stuff or make the perfect croissant or whatever. And their customers become evangelists for them. They spend a lot of money on them and they tell their friends, which means you get that double effect of a virtuous set of skilled baking evangelists and a variable pricing ranging from free through flour up to expensive masterclasses.
Is it not the idea then that companies, they just need to innovate?
Yes. I mean, obviously people should innovate. And the key for me here is that it can often be hard to figure out what your customers actually want. And one of the joys of the web is it enables you to experiment with that a lot more cheaply. Now, you can manufacture desire. Arguably, nobody knew they wanted an iPhone until the iPhone was created. In fact, definitely nobody knew they wanted an iPhone until it was created. So it's not the ultimate answer. And sometimes people don't understand what you're offering until they are touching it, holding it, feeling it, understanding it. What I think is the case is that you've always had to sell stuff to a retail buyer, a gatekeeper who controls what consumers have access to. Now you can build one-to-one connections with perhaps the top 10 or 20% of your audience who will be open to this new idea. And that gives you a really exciting place to start experimenting with new ideas and opportunities, some of which may become profitable but stay niche, and some of which may become profitable and go mainstream, making you rich beyond your wildest dreams.
That was Alid John down at the Monocle Cafe with Nicholas Lovell, author of The Curve, From Freeloaders into Superfans, The Future of Business. Up next, we meet a media venture in the Netherlands that doesn't care about the news agenda. Stay tuned.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Somalia has been a failed state for more than two decades, and if it's going to recover, then the airport in Mogadishu will play a key role.
Just a few years ago, the airport was nothing more than a military airbase and a target for mortars fired from nearby neighbourhoods that were under the control of Islamic insurgents. Now, there are daily scheduled passenger flights. But if you're not familiar with Somalia, then you'll still be in for a shock. This is not Heathrow, nor Schiphol. It's Mogadishu, and while things are getting better, the improvement is relative.
Words by Tristan McConnell, images by Pete Muller. Photo reportage at its best. Now playing on Monocle.com.
And you're back with Aperitivo 2043 in Istanbul, 1843 here in London. A new media venture has been launched this week in the Netherlands. The Correspondent, as the name may suggest, focuses only on what journalists on the ground deem important and ditches the concept of the news agenda. It's been fully crowdfunded, it's online only, and you need to pay to read its daily updated content. Monocle contributor in Amsterdam, Cynthia Taylor, spoke to the man behind it all, editor-in-chief Rob Weinberg. They chatted outside the Correspondent's office. Just like their new website, their building is also undergoing construction.
Let's sit here.
So, Rob, what makes the Correspondent different from any other media project in the Netherlands?
The Correspondent is different in many ways. The most important difference is that we do not focus on the general news you get everywhere else. We are an author platform, so our authors can discuss or make news of anything they deem important. It doesn't need a relationship to current affairs in the general sense of the word. The second thing is we are completely crowdfunded. We have no investors. We are paid by members only, and we have no advertisements. So this is a big difference for our business model. And then the third big difference is that we try to focus on a new kind of news, in the sense that we don't focus on exceptions to the rule, like accidents or conflicts or etc., but to the rule itself.
Was there a need to start such a project in the Netherlands?
I think so, because I felt the need, that's one thing. And let's say if you know the world only by the general news media outlets, only by following the news, then at the end of the day you understand exactly how the world doesn't work. You see all the exceptions to how the world works. To get a better understanding of how the world works, you have to have a different approach. And this was clearly missing in current media, and it's missing more and more because media are pretty much commercially driven. So what they seek is attention, and what we seek is insights. And apparently there are more people who think that there's a need for this, because we already have 20,000 plus subscribers.
So you're putting the news agenda in the Correspondent's, in the writer's hands. Does this mean that there is an end also to objectivity in journalism?
First of all, I don't think it came to an end, because it never existed. All decisions made by an editor or a group of editors or a newspaper are in essence subjective. It's their language that they use, it's their choices, the things they deem important. We only make it more explicit by telling our readers why we think something is important, instead of acting like, well, this is the news everywhere else, so this must be important. We explicitly add to our journalism why we think this is important, and in that sense we're making our subjective attitude known to the reader. Yeah.
But doesn't that take away somehow the focus on the story and on the people who are part of the story, and puts it on the journalist and on the writer?
Well, it may be a problem if the author or the writer became more important than his subject or his topic or the story itself. So this we don't want. But it's equally problematic if you act as if the author isn't important at all. Because a story is always told, and so the storyteller is maybe not more important, but as important as the story itself. You have to know why something is important. And if you want to know why something is important, then you have to have an author, a storyteller, to tell you this. Some people say, well, it's like celebrity journalism. But we don't want to make the storytellers well known. We want to make the stories well known by also letting our readers get to know the tellers of the stories.
How did you select your team? This requires a different type of journalist. Not every single journalist might be able to do this.
Yes. Well, one of the most important things in our selection was, what will be an interesting person or journalist to follow? Is your view of the world and what you deem important and what you find interesting, is that something I could find interesting as well? Are you a good storyteller? This is the most important. It's not so much the topic of your expertise, it's the fact that you can actually interest me in the topic you are interested in. That's the most important factor.
And it's a very young team. It's basically the 80s generation that is taking over. Was this a conscious decision?
Not everybody is as young as you imply here. We have a 86-year-old columnist as well. He was a journalist of the century, previous century in Holland. And we have in our editor's staff also somebody who's 45 years old, 40 years old. But we had some big names, well-known writers, authors, journalists. These authors helped us generate attention and also get our members. And they served as like a jumping board or a way for us to introduce new, talented, unknown young journalists to an audience.
Your business model, as you said, it's crowdfunded, it's quite risky, and people have to pay a fee for it.
Why do you think it's risky?
Because you don't have any advertisers, you don't have the big money coming in, right?
Ah, right. Well, I think it's more risky to be dependent on advertisement than on members. Because if you are only dependent on members, then you know who you are working for. And with advertisers, the reasons why they find your platform interesting are different from why readers most of the time find your platform interesting. So I think it's less risky to not have advertisers than more.
You're just starting. Where do you see yourself in a year?
In 1 year, that's a very important moment for us, but because then all our subscribers who we have now have to resubscribe. So maybe then I'm jobless and it's finished. Or maybe we have grown to even more subscribers and then we can do even more. Eventually, what we dream about is that now we have a small group of correspondents with different topics and expertises, etc. And eventually, we would like a very large network of correspondents all over the world with thousands of topics. So a reader can select what interests him most and what he thinks is most important and follow his favorite correspondents all over the world.
Do you think the correspondent will actually set a change in the media landscape in the Netherlands?
Maybe, maybe not. It's not. I don't think the road we have chosen to take is a recipe for all journalism. There are very many different kinds of journalism and many roads to proceed on. I think if it is a success, it may show other media or other people or other journalists that it is possible to actually earn money in this way without advertisements, but also online and also with quality journalism. I don't think, and I don't want to change the whole of journalism. My goal is to add something to journalism that I think is missing. And the more kinds of journalism there is available, the better it is.
That was Cynthia Taylor speaking to Rob Weinberg of The Correspondent in Amsterdam. 1851, Annabelle Bly and Daphne Denis will be in studio in a moment. But some music first. Their new album came out on Monday. It's called Days Are Gone. This is, I think, the best single from it. Don't Save Me, it's Heim. If your love isn't strong, see, I want there we are, Don't Save Me by Heim. The album is out now. And yes, I am the only person at Monocle 24 who can say Heim correctly. Right, what should we do now? Let's have a little chat about what's coming up later. I've got Annabelle Bly, hello.
Hello.
And Daphne Denis, hello.
Hello.
Here in the studio to talk about globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. Annabelle, you're doing Globus Asia, is that right?
I am, correct.
Okay, tell us what's coming up in, just over an hour's time. You've got the serious stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, it's a fairly serious show, but going to be very interesting. We've got Obama shortening his trip in Asia. Is this going to be significant?
I think this is a big mistake. I think it's, you know, what does it say about a country if you make a big deal that we're going to go to Malaysia, we're going to have a pivot towards Asia, we're going to go to Indonesia, and then actually, sorry, bit of a problem at home, can't go. And it's not a natural disaster problem or
no.
A tragedy problem. It's
self-inflicted.
My Congress are full of idiots.
Yeah,
full of idiots.
It doesn't send the best message about democracy.
It doesn't. It doesn't. And in fact, we're talking about democracy in the Monocle Daily as well, aren't we?
Yeah, we're talking about self-destructive democracy.
Not just America.
Who's worse, America or Italy?
Who do you prefer?
Well, Italy seems to be sort of slightly picking its game up today, and there seems to have been a bit of a deal with Enrico Letta, sort of had is still in office after Berlusconi said, yeah, okay, fine.
Indeed, Berlusconi lost on that one. So I guess Italy wins for once.
Okay. Talking of America and its problems, Daphne, we're going to be heading south, aren't we, to Texas?
Oh, yes, we are. We are. We're going to talk about the difficult task of picking textbooks in Texas. Why would it be difficult in your mind, Steve?
I think this has got something to do with evolution and certain people thinking that evolution is just, you know, a random theory that's up there with creationism.
Indeed, in Texas, there's a panel of 28 people who choose which textbooks go into schools. And out of those 28 members, there's six of them that don't believe in evolution.
And they're having a bit of an influence. So we'll be talking about that. And then also to flip back to the Globalist Asia, we've got a little bit of a chat about China and its involvement, not in Africa, as is often the way when we talk about China in other parts of the world, but in the Caribbean.
Yeah, this time China are in the Caribbean, not investing in resorts, but hoping to have influence over various countries to enable them to have just to get all the rare earth minerals that are
and
around the world.
There was an interesting stat that someone mentioned this morning when we were discussing this, which is that the economies, the combined strength of all the economies in the Caribbean is the same as Kansas. Now, I misheard them and thought they said Canada and thought, that's all right. but it was Kansas. So we'll be talking about that. So that's on the Globus Asia a little bit later. Michael Daly is at 2200 hours. Who are your hosts tonight? Annabelle on the Globus Asia?
We've got Andrew Muller.
Okay. And Daphne, you've got Andrew Muller as well.
We do with the one and only Emma Nelson.
Excellent. Andrew and Emma. So that's coming up at 2200 hours. Globus Asia in just over an hour's time at 2000 hours. But that's pretty much it for now for Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our guests, Rachel Shabby and Shashank Joshi. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by James Bullock. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the headlines and before Globalist Asia, it's the entrepreneurs. On the show, we meet a Lebanese entrepreneur who's developing an app to keep his fellow citizens safe from rising sectarian strife.
You hear a gunshot. Ideally, in 30 seconds, you should get a notification, the source location of the gunshot. You should know exactly where the person is located on a map, and it will show on your mobile phone.
That is coming up in about 5 minutes' time. Aperitivo will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours if you're on the East Coast. But from all of us here for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.